Imagine, you found a safe place to stay after a hurricane, just absolutely devastating, and then you're told you're being kicked out the next day.
Oh, wow.
That's what happened to families in western North Carolina
Really?
just this week, even after FEMA officially extended their temporary housing program.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's a confusing situation, for
Yes.
sure. We are diving deep into the chaos surrounding this program for those affected by Hurricane Helene.
It is a real head scratcher, you would think. With an official extension, things would be clear,
Right.
but that's not what happened.
No, not at all. Let's rewind for a moment to set the scene. Hurricane Helene hits western North Carolina, displacing thousands.
Thousands, yeah.
And FEMA steps in with its Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program,
Right.
TSA for short, which puts people in hotels while they, get back on their feet.
And initially, this program was a beacon of hope, a safe place to stay, a time to regroup, seemingly a lifeline for those who'd lost so much.
Exactly. FEMA even announces this extension of the TSA program until January 25th. You'd think
Yeah.
that would ease people's minds.
You would assume so, but then things take a sharp turn.
Yeah.
On January 15th, boom, news breaks that people are being evicted from these hotels despite the extension.
Oh.
Senators Ted Budd and Tom Tillis even go public on social media reporting dozens of families being kicked out.
And the details from Senator Tillis' report are just gut-wrenching. He's talking about folks going back to homes with mold, broken windows, freezing temperatures.
Oh my.
Imagine being forced back into those conditions.
It's a dire situation made even worse by the sudden eviction, and it raises serious questions about FEMA's operations.
Yeah.
We're claiming these people either had habitable homes to return to declined inspections or couldn't be contacted, but the senators are painting a very different picture.
So on one hand, you have FEMA saying everything is fine and under control.
Ooh.
On the other, you have elected officials saying there's a major problem.
Hmm.
Talk about mixed signals. This isn't some theoretical policy debate. This is impacting real people in a very real way right now.
Absolutely. It's a breakdown in communication and potentially implementation, leaving those who need help the most in a precarious position.
Wow.
This raises a crucial question. What happens when these systems fail? Who is responsible for catching those who fall through the cracks?
And to add another layer to this, Senator Budd directly contacts FEMA Administrator Dean Criswell, demanding immediate action.
And thankfully, FEMA responds, posting on X that eligible occupants can stay in hotels through March 2025.
Wow, that's a big difference.
Yeah, a much-needed clarification, but it does make you wonder, right? Shouldn't these issues have been foreseen? This reactive approach, while helpful in this instance, doesn't exactly inspire confidence for future
It
situations.
really makes you think. What does this situation tell you about the challenges of disaster relief and the need for accountability from government agencies? I mean, think about the stress and fear these families experience. This isn't just about logistics, it's about people's lives, their well-being hanging in the balance.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. This deep dive reveals a lot about FEMA's operations, highlighting the need for proactive planning and robust systems. FEMA is supposed to be a lifeline offering a sense of security in times of chaos, but this incident suggests there might be cracks in that lifeline.
Speaking of lifelines, if you're interested in learning more about weather and disaster preparedness, I highly recommend checking out meteorologist Rob Jones.
He's a fantastic resource. You can find him on Instagram at meteorologist, TikTok at TV meteorologist, and on YouTube, follow Hurricane Rob Jones, where you can also find the Meteorology Matters in the podcast playlist.
Okay, back to this FEMA situation. While there seems to be a resolution, this incident makes you wonder, how can we ensure vital aid reaches those who need it most? Especially when time is of the essence.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? It's not just about having resources. It's about having the right systems, the right communication channels, and the right people in place to ensure those resources reach those who need them when they need them.
It's almost like there needs to be a system of checks and balances to prevent these kinds of situations from happening in the first place.
And that's where the role of transparency and accountability comes in. We need systems that not only provide aid effectively, but are also transparent enough to be scrutinized and held accountable when things go wrong.
Transparency and accountability. Two words that seem to be missing in this initial response.
Absolutely. But the quick reversal by FEMA after the senators got involved is interesting. While it's a win for these families, it begs the question, what happens to those who don't have a senator championing their cause?
That's a really good point.
Oops.
Do FEMA systems favor those with louder voices? And this brings us to the heart of the matter. What can we learn from this situation to improve disaster relief efforts in the future? We'll dive into that in our next segment.
Picking up on that thought about, those who don't have powerful voices advocating for them, it's crucial to remember that behind these headlines and policy debates are real people.
Yeah.
Real families whose lives have been turned upside down.
That's so true. It's easy to be caught up in the big picture, the political back and forth. But at the end of the day, this is about people trying to piece their lives back together after a devastating event.
Exactly. And let's not forget, this situation with the hotel evictions is just one small piece of a much larger puzzle. The impact of a hurricane like Helene extends far beyond temporary housing.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about rebuilding homes, restoring livelihoods, addressing long-term health needs, and the emotional toll that lingers long after the storm has passed.
It's overwhelming to even think about. Where do you even begin to address all of those needs?
Well, it starts with understanding the resources that are available. You're probably familiar with FEMA's mandate, but for those listening who might not be FEMA, offers a variety of programs to help disaster survivors.
Right.
We're talking about things like financial assistance for home repairs, temporary rental assistance, grants for essential needs like food and clothing.
That sounds pretty comprehensive, at least on paper, but I have a feeling it's not always as straightforward as it seems.
You're absolutely right. Accessing those resources can be a real challenge. You see, FEMA's funding is often tied to congressional appropriations, which, as you can imagine, can be unpredictable.
Right.
This can create instability in how long programs can run, even with the best intentions.
So even if a program is designed to help people for a certain period of time, there's no guarantee that funding will be there to support it.
Precisely. And that uncertainty can make it incredibly difficult for people to plan and rebuild their lives.
Yeah, I bet.
On top of that, navigating the bureaucratic processes to apply for assistance can be a nightmare, especially when you're dealing with the stress and trauma of a disaster.
I can only imagine you've lost your home, your belongings, maybe even loved ones.
Yep.
And now you're faced with mountains of paperwork and complex eligibility requirements.
Exactly. And for many people, especially those who are already marginalized or vulnerable, those barriers can be insurmountable. Think about senior citizens who might not be tech savvy or have reliable transportation. Families who don't speak English as their first language, individuals with disabilities who might need additional support.
It's a reminder that disaster recovery is not a one-size-fits-all approach. We need systems that are flexible, adaptable, and truly responsive to the diverse needs of those affected.
Couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. We need to be asking ourselves, are we reaching everyone who needs help? Are we providing the right kind of assistance in a way that is accessible and dignified?
These are tough questions, but they're the ones we need to be asking if we're serious about improving disaster relief efforts. It can't just be about throwing money at the problem. It's about creating a system that truly works for those who need it most.
You've hit the nail on the head. It's about building a system that's as resilient and adaptable as the communities it serves. And speaking of resilient communities, let's shift gears for a moment and talk about the incredible outpouring of support we often see in the aftermath of disasters.
You know, it's easy to get bogged down in the negative aspects, bureaucratic hurdles, the systemic failures. But amidst all of that, there are always these amazing stories of human kindness and resilience that give you hope.
Absolutely. These stories are not just heartwarming anecdotes. They're actually a crucial part of understanding disaster recovery. In fact, there's a whole field of study dedicated to this, disaster sociology, which examines how communities respond to and recover from these events.
That's fascinating. So it's not just about the physical rebuilding. It's about the social and emotional recovery as well.
Precisely. Think about those images we often see after a disaster. Neighbors helping neighbors, clear debris volunteers, setting up makeshift kitchens to feed those who have lost everything.
Right.
Strangers donating clothes and supplies.
Those acts of kindness, those expressions of community solidarity, they're not just feel-good stories. They're actually essential to the recovery process.
Exactly. They provide a sense of hope. They strengthen social bonds, and they remind people that they're not alone in facing this challenge. These acts of mutual aid can sometimes be even more efficient than formal aid structures, especially in those crucial early days after a disaster.
That makes so much sense. The formal systems, while necessary, can be slow and cumbersome in those immediate moments after a disaster. It's often the neighbors, the local communities, who are best positioned to provide that immediate support.
Absolutely. It's about recognizing the power of grassroots mobilization and community-based solutions. These are the networks that often provide the most immediate and effective relief, and they play a vital role in fostering long-term recovery and resilience.
So while we certainly need to address the systemic issues within FEMA and other government agencies, it's also important to recognize and support those grassroots efforts that are happening on the ground.
You're absolutely right. It's about understanding that disaster response is not just a top-down process. It's a collaborative effort that involves all levels of society working together.
And that collaboration needs to extend beyond the immediate crisis. Rebuilding after a disaster is a long and arduous process, and communities need ongoing support to navigate the complexities of recovery, from accessing financial assistance to rebuilding homes to addressing the long-term mental health impacts.
You're hitting on a crucial point. The emotional and psychological toll of disasters often gets overlooked, but it's a critical part of the recovery process. Imagine the trauma of losing your home, your belongings, maybe even loved ones. The fear and uncertainty of starting over.
It's unimaginable. And those scars, those emotional wounds, they didn't just disappear when the debris is cleared.
Exactly. We need to recognize that mental health support is just as essential as physical rebuilding, providing access to counseling services, support groups, trauma-informed care. These are all critical components of a holistic and compassionate approach to disaster recovery.
It's about recognizing the human cost of these events and providing the support people need to not just rebuild their lives, but to heal and thrive in the aftermath.
Absolutely. Disaster recovery is not just about restoring physical structures. It's about restoring lives, restoring hope, and building a future where communities are stronger, more resilient, and better prepared to face whatever challenges may come.
You know, as we've been unpacking this situation with the FEMA hotel evictions, it's become clear that this isn't just an isolated incident. It feels like we're seeing more and more of these disaster-related challenges in the news lately.
You're picking up on a crucial point. The reality is we're living in an era of increasingly frequent and intense natural disasters fueled by climate change. And sadly, our current systems often struggle to keep up with the growing demand for effective disaster response.
That's a sobering thought. So if we're being honest with ourselves, are we truly prepared for what's coming?
That's the million-dollar question. And while there are pockets of excellence and dedicated individuals working tirelessly within these systems, the honest answer is we have a lot of work to do. We need a fundamental shift in how we approach disaster preparedness and response, one that moves beyond reactive measures and embraces a more proactive and holistic approach.
So let's shift gears from problem identification to solution-oriented thinking. If we're going to build a truly resilient system, where do we even begin?
One crucial starting point is acknowledging the elephant in the room, climate change. We can't keep treating these events as isolated incidents. We need to understand that the frequency and intensity of hurricanes, wildfires, floods, droughts, they're all being exacerbated by climate change.
Okay, so recognizing the reality of climate change is step one. What comes next?
Next comes action. We need to invest in mitigation efforts that reduce our vulnerability to these threats. This means strengthening building codes, improving infrastructure, protecting natural buffers like wetlands and forests, and developing comprehensive land use planning strategies.
It sounds like a multi-pronged approach is necessary, addressing the issue from multiple angles. So it's not just about reacting to the disaster. It's about minimizing the impact of future disasters.
Exactly. Think of it as a proactive investment. It might seem expensive up front, but it pales in comparison to the cost of constantly reacting and rebuilding after every disaster.
That makes a lot of sense. A stitch in time saves nine, as they say. But even with the best mitigation efforts, disasters will still happen. So how do we improve our response to those inevitable events?
Well, we need to go beyond simply providing immediate relief. We need to rethink the entire disaster management cycle, placing a greater emphasis on long-term recovery and building back better.
Building back better. I like that. So it's not just about returning to the status quo. It's about creating a more resilient and sustainable future.
Precisely. It's about learning from each disaster, identifying vulnerabilities, and implementing changes that make us stronger and better prepared for the next one.
Okay, so we've talked about mitigation, we've talked about long-term recovery, but there's another piece of this puzzle that we've touched on earlier, communication.
You're right, communication is key. We need to break down silos between different levels of government, foster collaboration between agencies and community organizations, and ensure that information flows efficiently and transparently to those who need it most.
It's almost like we need a centralized hub, a clearinghouse for information resources, and support something that connects individuals, communities, and government agencies seamlessly.
That's a great idea. And it's not just about sharing information. It's about coordinating efforts, streamlining processes, and ensuring that everyone is on the same page working towards the same goal.
This brings us back to the role of technology. We've already talked about how technology can enhance early warning systems and improve data analysis, but how else can we leverage technology to improve disaster response?
There's so much potential. Imagine interactive maps that provide real-time information on shelter locations, evacuation routes, and available resources. Or mobile apps that connect people in need with volunteers and aid organizations.
Those are great examples.
Yeah.
Technology can be a powerful tool for connecting people, sharing information, and coordinating resources. It's almost like having a digital disaster response toolkit right at your fingertips.
Exactly. And these tools can be particularly helpful for those who are often marginalized or overlooked in traditional disaster response efforts, seniors, people with disabilities, non-English speakers. Technology can help us bridge those gaps and ensure that everyone has access to the support they need.
That's a crucial point.
Mm-hmm.
Disaster preparedness and response should be inclusive and equitable. It's about ensuring that everyone, regardless of their background or circumstances, has the opportunity to not just survive, but to thrive.
Couldn't agree more. And it's not just about governments and large organizations taking the lead. Individuals and communities have a crucial role to play as well.
This brings us back to the incredible stories of resilience and community support we discussed earlier. Those neighbors helping neighbors, those volunteers offering their time and resources, that's where the true spirit of resilience shines through.
Absolutely. It's a powerful reminder that we're not just individuals facing these challenges. We're communities. We're networks of support. And by working together, we can amplify our impact and build a truly resilient future.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's the one message you want our listeners to take away?
I want them to remember that disaster preparedness is not just a government responsibility, it's a shared responsibility. It's about individuals taking steps to prepare their homes and families, communities coming together to support each other, and governments investing in the resources and systems that make us all safer.
Well said. It's about recognizing that we're all in this together, and that by working collaboratively, we can build a future where communities are empowered. Disasters are mitigated, and resilience is not just a reaction to adversity, but a way of life. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it sparked your curiosity, ignited your passion for change, and inspired you to take action.
Until next time, stay safe, stay informed, and stay engaged.